Welcome to Magic by Design. If you're listening for the first time, thanks so much for stopping by. We are delighted to have you with us. You're jumping on board our humble Disney-themed podcast at a great time, as we are right in the middle of the Disney Renaissance of the 1990s. We are on a journey to watch and review every theatrically released Disney animated feature film. Each and every week, we break down a movie from the Disney canon in an attempt to discover the secrets behind the magic. We literally just watched Disney's 32nd animated feature film, The Lion King, but before we take our place in the circle of life, allow me to introduce myself. I'm Ken, and I am joined, as always, by my co-host slash brother Garrett. Gar, how are you?
Where do lions rank on your list of preferred animals?
I don't know.
Bears are pretty cool.
Bears are
all cool. Kinds of bears are cool, because you get panda bears, you get polar bears, you get grizzly bears.
Red pandas are adorable.
You get koala bears. Are koala bears, like, in the same bear family as bear bears? Wee bear bears?
I think so.
Probably. I assume if the word bear is there, you'd have to think so, but...
Sometimes they're in different genuses and species and stuff like that.
Like, I'm not a big monkey guy.
I like elephants.
Elephants are quite majestic.
Elephant, like, they have the same power. They could be king of the jungle if they wanted, but they're just gentle... Peaceful people. I was going to say people, but they're animals.
Too busy snorting water up their noses.
Yeah. Because, like, an elephant can definitely overpower a lion.
I don't, like, a lion is quicker. So, like, if a lion gets an elephant from behind, the elephant is probably screwed.
Yeah.
Because the elephant can't turn fast enough.
But their hide is quite tough, so do you think a lion's teeth could penetrate it?
I don't know, but you'd probably be able to do some damage.
Yeah, that's true.
There's probably footage of frickin' lions trying to take down elephants. Or maybe they don't do it, just because... They're scared, because elephants are gigantic.
There's much easier things to take down if you're a lion.
Yes, in the circle of life, if you will.
I enjoy a penguin, because they're stranger
things. Penguins are adorable. Look at their little tuxedos.
And they're waddling along.
They do waddle. It's very funny.
This is probably the Disney film I've watched more than any other. It's the first Disney film we saw together in the cinema, if you remember, Gar.
Is it the first film I ever saw in the cinema? I think it is.
Could be. We actually missed the iconic opening due to being late for the movie.
I don't remember this.
You don't?
I know I was there, but I was two.
Yeah, that's fair.
So, like, I don't... Like, my first memory is Power Rangers. I remember going to see Power Rangers. I remember the whole ordeal of seeing Power Rangers. But in terms of actually the cinematic experience of seeing this film, absolutely no memory of it whatsoever. Except when we saw the 3D remake.
This is probably the first Disney film I saw twice in the cinema, for that reason.
But three times if you include the live-action remake.
Yeah.
Which,
we'll talk about
listen,
that
we're going to go straight into the live-action remake. The reason the live-action remake does not work, and it becomes even more obvious when you watch the animated film, is because they used realistic-looking lions. And watch this film, watch it closely, and you realize, like, a good 70-80% of what is communicated through the viewer is done through the body language and facial expressions of the characters. And we'll talk about this probably in more depth, but they are the most detailed and like... specific those facial expressions have ever been. Like, every single expression of Simba, every expression of happiness, of cocky charm, of sadness, all of that, like, it's captured in his eyes. He doesn't need to say a word in this film. And when you watch the live action remake, they just have those lion faces
with those dead eyes,
and the lion faces just do not move, and you lose so much of the character of the film. You lose so much of the emotion of the film. You lose all of, like, the sense of what these characters are feeling at any given moment. If it's not directly communicated through what they're saying, you just don't see it. So when Mufasa dies, and it, like, in this film, when Simba, like, sadly crawls under the arm, and when Simba's, like, pawing at the face, and when Simba's accepting the fact that his father has just died, it's devastating. Like, it hits you like a ton of bricks, because it hits Simba like a ton of bricks, and it's tremendously animated. But then when... I'm waving my hands a lot today for some reason. Which people can't see. But when he dies in the animated, or in the live-action film, you just get the weird, stoic-looking lions with none of the facial features, and it's terrible. It just does not work, and it does not do the original film justice, which is the reason I think I mentioned this on one of our older podcasts. It would be a shame if the definitive version of The Lion King, for some people, for, like, the generation that grew up as children and saw that film in 2019 or 2018? Last year.
19,
yeah.
It's been a long year.
It has. It's been a long decade. But, like, the people who have seen that film, like, the people growing up who would have seen that film first before seeing the 1994 film, it would be an absolute travesty if that's their version of the film, because it's so inferior for that very clear reason. Like, you lose everything without those expressions.
I completely agree. Like, one of the things I said to you when we were watching this film is that the death of Mufasa hits me way more in this film. It, like, the live action, well, it's not even live action, it's like an animation film.
Actually, it's a HD remake.
It's actually the highest grossing animated film of all time, I think.
It's a HD remake. It's weird to call it because, like, oh, it's the live action version of the Lion. It's not. It's a HD remake.
But I think you hit the nail on the head there. It just doesn't feel the same. Like, it has the same beats. It's a shot-for-shot remake. You know what's coming. Mm-hmm. But, like, I feel more of a sense of dread. I talked about this when we watched the movie as well. I get very anxious as we build up to the stampede scene. And then afterwards, I kind of relax because, you know, it's quite a lot of comedy after that for quite a stretch of the movie. But
yeah, you get the no worries portion.
In the live-action Lion King, it should be more distressing because it's realistic.
But it should be more detailed, but the problem is it's less detailed. You get less of the emotion, you get less of the feeling, you get less of that oomph of it. And you get less, most importantly, of how the characters feel about this, both Scar and Simba. You get less of, like, because as I said, it hits you like a ton of bricks because it hits Simba like a ton of bricks, and you see it. You see every bit of it in its face. Because this is the best animated film they've ever made in terms of, like, level and detail of animation. They've never done facial expressions this detailed. Like, usually they have, like, their kind of solid range. But, like, every look on his face, every suspicious look, every happy look, every, like, smug look, Simba has that entire range. And it's so well animated. This film, like, it looks better in the first 2 minutes than all of Aladdin looks.
It's the same for Scar as well, because Scar has these subtle little looks where you could see the wheels turning in his face. The plot doesn't actually go to plan, but you could see him adjusting on the fly. And there's a bit where, obviously, Mufasa and him go to save Simba from the stampede. And the look of, like, fake concern on his face, even though he's the one that orchestrated all of it. There's such subtleties in there.
And this film has all those, like, little attention to detail bits. Like, as I mentioned while watching, like, earlier when we first meet Scar, he sharpens his claws off the wall. Just so, like, they lay that little seed about his claws before he sinks them into Mufasa and kills him. Yeah. And sends him catapulting off that cliff. And, like, Chiwetel Ejiofor did the voice of Scar in the live-action remake.
Good trigger.
Close enough. But I don't know. I'm sure he was fine. I have no memory of him being, like, good or bad. I'm sure, like, all the voice performances were fine.
They left in Be Prepared, but they didn't do it justice. I think that really was a minus for that film as well.
And, like, Jeremy Irons, like, we were talking about Disney villains and, like, how I thought Jafar didn't feel particularly fleshed out. He didn't feel particularly specific. And I thought he was a good character design that didn't have any of, like, the depth and layers you'd want. Scar has all of the depth and layer you want.
There's a lot of questions that you have about how Scar came to be. What was he called before he was called Scar?
Yeah, his because name was like Jeremy.
That's clearly a nickname because he wasn't called Scar before. Funnily enough, the Disney Junior show, The Lion Guard, which is about Simba and Nala's son. Oh God, what's his name again? I can't remember. Kion. And it goes into the lore a bit more. So it talks about Scar and all that background and stuff like that. So it's kind of strange that...
But do they give him a name?
I don't think... I haven't seen it all. A friend of the show, Cora, who watches a lot, mentioned it to me that they do flesh out the universe a lot. So even though it's like a show aimed at young children, I've been meaning to watch it because apparently it does build in a lot of that stuff that you want to know when watching this film. I'd watch a Scar prequel, like an origin story for Scar.
You know what I like? They never tell you how he got the Scar.
Yeah.
And you know how he got the Scar. In a failed challenge of Simba. Like, everybody Mufasa. Knows that. Or Mufasa, yes. Like, you can infer that watching the film. And I actually think that adds a wonder... Because then you think about the name Scar. Like, he challenged Mufasa, failed, got a permanent scar over his eye, and for the rest of his life, they called him Scar. Rest of his life, they're like, you failed.
Rubbing it in at every opportunity.
And, like, that's not in this film. Like that. That's me inferring things based on the storytelling of this film.
I read it the same, in fairness.
Yeah, and I think you're intended to read it. But, like, that is a wonderful, you know, like, villain origin. Because, like, he's perfectly kind of justified in getting... Like, fair enough, it's his fault for challenging Mufasa in the first place. And his fault for being a loser.
Yeah.
But, like, that hangs with him for the rest... His name changes because of this.
So all this baggage and all this hatred and this jealousy is there. And it doesn't need to be said. There's no exposition, but we know it's there.
Well, there's
there.
A little exposition.
A little bit. But, like, I think we're jumping a little bit far ahead. I just want to go into the background a little bit. Development on The Lion King began during a meeting between Jeffrey Katzenberg Spielberg, Roy E. Disney, and Peter Schneider while promoting Oliver and Company in Europe. Production began in 1991 concurrently with Pocahontas. This is a really interesting point. This is the only reason I wanted to go back a bit. The first trailer of The Lion King featured the entire Circle of Life sequence and was released in November 1993, so about 8 months before it was released.
I mentioned this to you while watching it, but like, if you took that 2 minutes... That 2 minute sequence where all the animals show up, Circle of Life plays, and Rafiki holds Simba over the mountain, or over the Pride Rock. Is Pride Rock a mountain? I guess it's in the name, it's a rock. Over the rock for the entire animal kingdom to celebrate the welcoming of the future to be to be king. It's like, if you just released that as a single 2 minute animated short, it's a masterpiece in and of itself. In the piece of like little self-contained storytelling, like that sequence looks prettier than all of Aladdin does.
Yeah, I mean...
And like, there's more to work with. You have all these animals, you have like the animal kingdom, you have brighter colors, you have more like more vibrant, as opposed to like yellow buildings, yellow sand. That's where Aladdin's set, so that's what it looks like. And it's not like a particularly visually impressive film. And then you watch this, and those first 2 minutes are just the best 2 minutes of animation Disney has ever produced. Ever, up until this point.
Yeah, they've done animals in the past, but these animals are highly detailed, realistic in their movements. So, as you know, Disney in the past have had a habit of anthropomorphizing animals, mm-hmm. but they have to learn how to actually draw animals on all fours, which is a challenge for them.
And like, if you go back to what's the previous before this, what's the other prettiest Disney film?
Bambi?
It's Bambi. Yeah. So if you go back, it's still animals, it's still forest environments, and that's probably a connection there, because as I said, in terms of like vibrant color palettes and like detailed things, like doing the people are very boring, let's face it.
Well, Don Hahn, the producer for The Lion King, explicitly stated that they were trying to create Bambi in Africa.
Yeah, so they
did. That was the brief.
And like people, there's been many accusations of what this film is based on.
Yeah, we'll get into that in a while. It's on the agenda here.
Both legally and illegally, because it's based on Hamlet and based on some biblical stories as well, isn't it?
Joseph and Moses, apparently.
Yeah. And then as well as Kimba the White Lion. But also, as you said, we got the Disney hush money too.
The funny thing is, I only get that Kimba gag in The Simpsons now, like years later. I never got it at the time.
Now it all makes sense. It all adds up. But like as you said, it's also based on... Like if you look at the larger beats of this film, down to freaking the thing ending in a forest fire. But it's a Pride Rock fire, I guess. But the parent dying in the middle as the formative thing and the growing up and falling in love. Like... The beats are pretty much the same as Bambi as well. So yeah,
it's the same formula.
There are many different inspirations for this film.
Anyway, going back to the trailer, Buena Vista Pictures Distribution President Dick Cook said the decision was made for such an approach because it was unusual for the time to show a sequence from the movie as the trailer. We were also taken by the beauty and majesty of this piece that we felt like it was probably the best 4 minutes of film that we've seen. Don Hahn added the Circle of Life worked as a trailer because it came off so strong and so good and ended with a bang. At this point, only a third of the film had been produced, and it was so well received that filmmakers initially had concerns that the finished film would not live up to expectations.
As I said, like that, that Circle of Life sequence is the best piece of animation Disney has ever produced up until this point.
And it sets the table, like, and you know, Up, the opening of Up, you know, basically won it the Oscar nomination.
Yeah, the Oscar nomination is for the first 10 minutes of that film. And the rest of that film is good, but the Oscar nomination is for the first 10 minutes.
I'm kind of surprised that wasn't the case here as well.
It didn't get nominated for Best Picture?
It did not.
What did it get? I assume it did. When did they introduce it? The animated category didn't get introduced until 2000, 2001. Which is so late. I guess maybe because like there wasn't enough competition, and that might have been the issue. That like maybe there just wasn't enough animated films being released a year to justify doing like an award for it, because it would just be like, and now it goes to the Disney one this year, because it's one of the two we can choose from, as opposed to now when you do get like 10 big animated films released by different studios every year. But this, like, it's the best. It's so good. It's such a good piece of animation, and it works. And the reason they could release it as a trailer is because it works as this self-contained piece. Yeah. It sets the tone for the film and tells you a lot about the story that's going to come. But if you just watch it in and of itself, it works as this wonderful self-contained piece. God, it's such a good piece of animation.
No, it's not possibly. It is the best opening to a Disney film of all time.
Oh yeah, far and away. Like, there is a reason this film is beloved. Like, people love Space Jam. I love Space Jam.
Me too.
Space Jam's not very good.
Not really.
You know,
a nostalgia thing.
Yeah, you look back and it's like, oh, you know, this was a moment in time and it's a great fun, but is it good? Not really. You watch The Lion King and there is a reason it has the cultural cache that it does. It's because it's an exemplary piece of animation. It's great story. Storytelling. It is fantastic music. So like it holds that cultural cache for such a good reason. And like the Disney Renaissance was a thing for such a good reason, because we had the Little Mermaid. We had Oliver and Company beforehand. We won't leave Oliver and Company out. But then we had Beauty and the Beast. We have Aladdin. We have The Lion King. And this is the period that's like, as I said, I don't think Aladdin is a particularly great piece of filmmaking. I think it's carried by a Robin Williams performance and some good songs. But like the story and all the underlying stuff is nowhere near as good as either Beauty and the Beast before it or The Lion King after it. But when you consider it as part of that like streak of animated hits, they're really hitting on something here, Ken.
It's phenomenal, and it's been interesting to watch these films back to back, because you're seeing all the elements come together. The storytelling is getting better, the animation is getting better because of the technology.
You speak to the anime, but like I would never have like picked out how good the animation in this film actually is without watching the 32 or whatever films that preceded it.
31.
We're on 32. Damn, I'll never get this number right. I'm always one off. But like, I never like this. It's weird that like I think I've probably watched The Lion King top to bottom like 3 or 4 times in my life, and then seen like, you know, it's on TV, you watch another 15 minutes of it here and there. But like, I don't think I've ever been like, whoa, look how good this looks. Because like, I watched The Lion King with the eyes of, you know, looking back on it either as a child or watching it in 2020 while seeing it compared to like the work Pixar are doing in 2020, which is off the chain. But when you watch it, in watch these films in sequence and see where they came from in the 80s with, I don't know, like even like we watched Pooh, and then I have them literally listed on this board behind me. We watched Fox and the Hound, and then you get to stuff like this, and it's such a jump over the space of 20 years when there wasn't a jump, which was actually quite remarkable. Like from the 50s to the 80s, I don't think the animation changed much.
But even if you talk about the likes of the Fox and the Hound and the Black Cauldron, that's only the space of film. No. How dare you?
Respectable.
That's only the space of a few years, but yeah. The leap in terms of the technical achievement and the actual animation evolution is almost unrecognizable.
And it's really interesting to think that from Snow White through to, what was the first film that had 3D elements?
I believe that was The Black Cauldron.
It was The Black Cauldron, yeah. So through to The Black Cauldron, these films were done the same.
Pretty much. Possibly even worse.
Yeah, and like based on the budget they had and based on the time and effort they had, some like we go Aristocats levels of depths of horror when you compare that to like Sleeping Beauty and Bambi, which are beautiful films. And now you're moving into the era where we have a major technological advancement. We have computer generated animation. Even if it's not 3D, it's still computer generated and it looks much better. It's and I was kind of like bemoaning, it's like, oh, the loss of the painterly style. Look, films look like this now. You know? So
yeah. It's somewhere in between. It's somewhere between painterly and graphical, which I think just creates a smoothness and a kind of a pleasing effect on the eye that really makes it a step above what we'd have been doing in the previous decade.
Because you have the sprawling wide shots of the savannah. You have the sprawling wide shots of the Pride Lands and of the unnamed place where Simba goes to live with Timon and Pumbaa. You have those beautiful...
Who's the king of that place?
Yeah, maybe Simba is, I guess. He's a lion. Who's going to contest it?
True. The animation team visited Hell's Gate National Park in Kenya to research the film. That's what the Pride Lands is based on.
I would love to get one of these jobs where it's like, yes, we need to go to Kenya for research.
And in fairness, it does pay off.
It does.
You do see it in the film. The opening sequence, as we said, gives me goosebumps every time, especially when Circuit of Life kicks in. So that I'm not going to do the traditional chant by Lipo M because it's too much a cultural appropriation. But do you know when it hits? It gets me in the heart every time.
Yeah.
You know, just like... It just piques my emotions, and from there on, I'm an emotional wreck. Not only is it gorgeous, but the skill in animating all those animals was incredible for the time.
Especially the number of them.
Yeah.
Like, there are some corners cut every so often with some wide shots, but, like, there's, like, fully detailed animated animals in a row, and it's not like the, you know, lazy, or if you go back and watch Dumbo with the crowd shots, where it's like, there's just no detail there.
Sometimes they don't even have faces.
Most of the time, they don't even have faces, and here we're just doing, like, giant scenes of, like, hundreds of animals, all of which are animated.
I can see why they stylized the animals for the I Just Can't Wait to Be King sequence, though, because it would have been too difficult to make them realistic to have that kind of... more of a cartoonish sequence, so I can see why they went with a different direction. They're more stylized, almost in an Art Deco kind of style.
And it gives that sequence something different from the rest of the film.
Garrett, the stampede scene for me is the greatest technical achievement of this film. It was created in 3D, so they created 4 to 5 wildebeest in a computer and... obviously they were wireframes, and then they animated them on random paths. So like one of them would be going straight, one of them would be leaping left to right, that kind of thing. And then they used cel shading. So this is the most excellent example of a cel shading I've ever seen in a movie to make it look like 2D animation.
Mm.
And then they had these randomized paths, and then they just duplicated them. So
and then they'd add animate Mufasa around that then.
Yeah, and then you can see in the foreground, though, the foreground, that's traditional animation. They have like a few wildebeest in the foreground running, but like when you're seeing them cascade down the hill, that's the 3D effect and the randomized patterns.
Mm.
But like it creates this kind of sense of chaos and randomness, even though it's ones and zeros. That's actually meticulously planned. It took the animators, I think it's a team of four animators, 2 years to do this 2 minute sequence alone. But it's
those poor guys.
It's a and I think it's like
it's worth it.
It's worth it, and it coupled with the score, it just creates this sense of dread and chaos that really, it just really gets my anxiety up. Even though I know it's coming, I watch it every time.
You hate it so much. We have we're going to bounce all over the place with this one because it's The Lion King. The score, Hans Zimmer. I don't think ever, like, I think he's been living off this score ever since this and the freaking Pirates of the Caribbean score. Because like the problem was Hans Zimmer did Inception then, and then everybody wanted him to do the Inception score, and it's like the Inception score works for Inception, but it's cliche and boring now.
Every trailer has wah.
Yeah, just the boss. You get the wah. Whereas this score, like, it just underscores the emotional depth. That's probably where the term score comes from.
This is a note I had. I adore the score from this movie, much like you. I often listen to it before I sleep, and I am in awe of the range of emotions it conveys.
Mm.
Celebration, joy, sorrow, hope, reflection, redemption, just to name a few. I don't think we've seen a score have such an influence on a Disney movie since Bambi. It actually, to your point, like in Bambi, the score acts as a part of the storytelling. It cues our emotions. It tells us how we should be feeling. It's the exact same in The Lion King.
And it's like, it's interesting because like we've got a lot of Menken scores lately, and Menken is a genius. But this is very different. It's a very different score, and like the music does like the, neither Menken or obviously Howard Ashman have passed away at this point. So you get Tim Rice and freaking Elton John working on this film. So like you get that musical variety from film to film as well. As you said, like the This Land theme, go and listen to it. If you haven't listened to that piece of music in a while and you listen to it, it'll just slap you straight in the face.
Just makes me sad and melancholic and hopeful all at the same time.
It has all of that range, and especially if you attach the emotional arc of this film to that music, which I think that's the way this film was meant to be designed, that these things are meant to complement each other. So when did you hear the This Land theme? When you hear the do 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 do, you hear like in your head, you're like, remember who you are. You hear that, and it's like, oh, the score in this film is absolutely fantastic. It's the best work of Hans Zimmer's career, which I think is saying a lot given the amount Hans Zimmer worked on.
Sure, to your point, Gary, let's stick with the music and we'll bounce back to the story, because I think it's worth staying on that thread since we're talking about it.
Work is chaos. We're just gonna Ken Haya. I immediately threw the format out the window by talking about the freaking,
it panics me, Gary, I'm sorry.
The live action remake.
Elton John was initially reluctant to do the music for the film, and some people say that he said it was beneath him at the time, and like I can't see any quotes for that, because any quote I've seen said that he was looking forward to doing something that was for kids but also for adults. But you know, obviously it makes him a lot of money, and it's probably one of the things he's most remembered for, at least in our generation. But I think to your point,
Jungle Book was a big inspiration for him as well, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That he wanted those like big poppy catchy songs,
yeah,
but that are also for kids.
It does create a different feeling, because I think that they could have stuck with the winning formula of Menken, and I know Tim Rice was involved in Aladdin as well.
Mm-hmm.
And as you said, unfortunately, Howard Ashman had passed away. You could have stuck with the winning formula and stuck with Menken and Rice, but this created something different. And I think that like one of the things that's great about the Disney Renaissance was as they built confidence back in the animation process, and you know, these films were making money and they were putting resources in them, they weren't afraid to take those risks. And I think that it really pays off.
There's part of my brain now that earlier thinks I said Tim Curry instead of Tim Rice. Like, you'll find out when you edit this. And if it's not, that's a funny...
I'll just put it in when he said it there. It'll be like, Tim Rice.
If it was written by Tim Curry, it would be very different music, I'd imagine.
Uh-huh.
Did you see the people that were meant to attach to this first before Elton John?
No.
ABBA.
Oh, yes, yeah, sorry, I saw that.
They wanted ABBA for it, but couldn't get them. Imagine this film with ABBA music.
Be prepared.
Yeah, it would be so different.
I think it would be too upbeat, because there's a strong conversation to be had that Be Prepared is the greatest Disney villain song of all time.
It is. And Jeremy Irons is fantastic. Jeremy Irons is so good, even though, as you go, deliver your tidbit.
Fun fact, Jim Cummings does the end because Jeremy Irons couldn't get up there in terms of the range.
Yeah, so, but like, Jeremy Irons is so good in this film. And you can tell he's not phoning it in. Like, you know, a lot of people, they get in the booth with some hot chocolate in their hand, covered in a shawl, and they're like cynically reading out the latest animated film's lines without really embodying in any way. Maybe he did do that, maybe he's just this good. But Jeremy Irons is fantastic in this film.
It sounds to me that he treated it like a Shakespearean performance.
He did, and maybe that's where, like, the Hamlet comparison, maybe they're like, this is Hamlet. I'd imagine Jeremy Irons has probably done Hamlet at some time in his life.
Yeah, like, maybe that's what attracted him to the project.
So it's like, this is what we're doing here, and he's like, oh yeah, I get it. He knows exactly what this character is meant to be, and how, like, I don't know where the phrase chewing scenery came from, but like, Scar chews all the scenery that can be chewed.
And he has these little quips, but he's also very sinister. And going into the story here, having Scar kill Mufasa is a very big swing for a Disney movie. We've seen implied killings and death, but never a murder.
Bambi's the big one.
Yeah.
Or like, that's the big, but that happened off screen. Well, it kind of happens on screen. We hear the gunshot.
Yeah, where this is the first time we actually see a dead body in a Disney film.
Yeah, and like, as I said, the moment where Simba is trying to get his father to get up. And then like, the real heartbreaking bit is when he goes and lies under Mufasa's paw and lays there with his father before Scar menacingly emerges from the dust in the background. There's like, ah, oh, that's just, it's so perfect. And it has all the character beats you need for all of these people. This, it does feel so like, oh, generic and lazy to be like, The Lion King is the best Disney film. But up until this point, The Lion King is the best Disney film.
Like, this really puts Scar in a bracket all of his own as a Disney villain, as well as the song. It's just, like, something that you've just never seen in a Disney film. An act of pure jealousy and rage. It's really dark stuff, but it also makes the moments of levity afterwards really important.
But, like, when you look at the Disney villains so far, usually all of them have something. Ratigan has a great, like, performance and a bit of backstory. And then you look at Ursula, who has, like, a really good song. And you look at Maleficent, who's, like, great character design. Whereas then you look at Scar, great performance, iconic, like character design, the best villain song, tremendous backstory. It's like, he just has it all. Like, I don't think there's another Disney villain that has all of those pieces and puts it together so well.
I think the important thing as well is that they did a really amazing job of making us care about Mufasa in a relatively short space of time, less than 40 minutes.
I think the worst line in the film, though, but actually, no, it pivots into something good, so I'll allow it. But when Simba's like, you and I will be together forever, right, Dad? And then it's like, oh, he's dying 5 minutes later. It's like, all right, but then it does pivot into the scene where he tells him about the kings of the past looking down from the stars. So I'll allow it, because I think that's actually a very nice scene.
Yeah, they really set us up for the gut punch, but the storytelling here is really tight and economical. We know Mufasa is wise, you know, in a very short space of time, we know he's wise.
Do we, though?
We know he's noble, he's a great...
Maybe this is unreliable narrator, because we obviously we see the majority of the film from the perspective of Simba, who of course thinks his father is like the coolest guy on earth. So maybe Mufasa is an unfair leader, maybe the hyenas are unfairly kept down and held out and starved out, and maybe it's somewhat the hubris of Mufasa that has led to this, Ken. Maybe it's his neglect of that group of animals. Why don't they get the same treatment as the elephants and all these other things?
Well, I think there's some articles online to say, like, Scar is not the villain of this film, and he is.
And he's not. This is me doing the freaking Cruella de Vil's the good guy routine again, all over again.
Well, but I think they would be allowed to live in the Pride Lands if they weren't so selfish, because, you know.
But the lion's all, like, the Mufasa's like, and then we eat all these things, but we die, and they eat us in the end. So it's like, everything's fine, circle of life, the hyenas die.
But they're greedy, and they overhunt, and they overeat, and they drive
the
animals away.
But it's fun to do devil's advocate about stupid children's entertainment.
But the point is, like, in a short space of time, we get this feeling of a wise and noble leader and a great father. That's why it packs such a punch when he is killed. And one of the most haunting parts of the movie, it's not when he actually dies, but it's, again, it goes back to the range of emotion and the seeing that in the eyes when Scar digs his claws into Mufasa's paws and he's like, brother, help me, and he knows, like, you can see in his face that it dawns on him that he's been betrayed and he knows he's going to die. That, like, I can see it now in my mind's eye. It's just absolutely haunting. But, like, the point I'm trying to make is that
you don't want to see the generic empty lion face. Just like, yeah. I'm making an empty lion face for you podcast, which is everybody.
But yeah, the thing that makes Scar so devilishly evil and really makes it hit hard is obviously the reaction of Simba, but the fact that we've invested so much in Mufasa and that, you know, we've grown to love him in only a short space of time.
Yeah, he's like 15 minutes on screen, maybe?
Yeah, that contrast between him and Scar, the fact that it feels so unjust that he's taken before his time, really elevates Scar. It's like, you really hate him instantly.
We need to talk about Scar's plan.
Go ahead.
All right, so his intent is to kill both Simba and Mufasa.
Right.
But, like, he also has the remarkable foresight to frame Simba.
Yeah.
Just in case, you know, the backup plan.
Again, that's why I said, like, that's why he's a cunning villain, because things didn't go quite as smoothly as he had planned, and he was adjusting on the fly.
And he had to get his paws dirty and kill Mufasa himself.
Yeah.
But that maybe like might be my slight bit of overwriting. It's like, he really had the foresight to think to make Simba feel like he caused the thing, even though you intended to kill Simba regardless. But nonetheless, he's clearly very smart. He's thinking all the eventualities. What if, maybe he had an eventuality for what if Simba died and Mufasa lived. Maybe he was like, oh, what'll I do then? And there is a line in Be Prepared about being like, meticulous planning. So like, you know, he mentions it.
He probably has all the angles worked out 5 steps in advance. As we mentioned here, Pocahontas attracted many of Disney's best animators because it was in production at the same time. Many animators who were assigned to The Lion King wanted off the project to work on Pocahontas because most thought that it would be the most successful and prestigious film. How wrong they were, Gar, but I think this was a major factor in the film's success because those who stayed were clearly passionate and really worked hard to create something special. A quote here from Don Hahn again. The Lion King was considered a little movie because we were going to take some risks. The pitch for the story was a lion cub gets framed for murder by his uncle, set to the music of Elton John. People said, what? Good luck with that. But for some reason, the people who ended up on the movie were highly passionate about it and motivated.
It tells you, you can't pick them either.
No.
Like, everyone in Disney is like, Pocahontas is this big prestige project. It's going to be like our next Beauty and the Beast. We're swinging for the fences. It's going to be amazing. And we're going to give it $10 million more for the budget. And it's the one everyone wants to work on. And then you get The Lion King, which is like Hamlet but lions. And they make that biggest hit, ginormous cultural impact, one of the most important animated films ever made. So you can't pick them.
Another thing that really floors me about this movie, the sequence where Mufasa returns to encourage Simba to embrace his destiny was not part of the original script. In the original script, Rafiki simply convinces Simba to return. This is my favorite part of the movie by far, and to me, it's the key sequence that makes the whole film work, as well as being beautifully animated and haunting.
Shout out to the musical, which also introduces a banger of a song there, because He Lives in You rules. I wish they actually just put that in the film, because it's a great, and it's
in the second film.
Because like realistically, that's where that should be. Did they put that in the remake? Because they added a song after that moment in the remake.
I can't remember what it was.
Because like, there's a song when he's running back to the Pride Lab, isn't there?
Oh, that's Spirit by Beyoncé.
Which, if you were ever going to put He Lives in You back into the original film, right there is where you put it.
But they wanted a Beyoncé pop song.
Of course they wanted a Beyoncé pop song.
It really did not fit.
Which, by the way, you've seen the musical as well, haven't you?
I have.
Which, the staging of the Stampede moment is just amazingly done in the musical as well.
Yeah, they use puppets.
Yeah, it's so, so well done in the musical. Like, the staging of all of that is fantastic.
The Lion King is a coming-of-age story at its heart. We have themes of loss and grief.
Simba's a runt. Simba's a very 90s kid.
Yeah, he is.
He's, like, earnest, wide-eyed, but, like, pugnacious and abrasive. But
they even had the pugnacious kid of the time, Jonathan Taylor Thomas, play Simba. Well, the acting voice.
The voice of Simba, yeah. So it's like, he's such a 90s kid. It's like, look at you from the 90s with that 90s attitude, trying to be like a slightly more wholesome version of Bart Simpson, because it all came from Bart Simpson. That's where all of those children like are like somewhere on the taxonomy of Bart Simpson. Somewhere they're all inspired by him in some way or another.
One of the things that really strikes me is that I've seen a lot of stories, and Don Hahn said this as well, because I saw an interview with him. That's why I keep going back to Don Hahn, who produced the film. There are stories of people using the film to explain the concept of loss to their children when they lost a parent or they lost a loved one. That's like, no, yes, they're gone, but you know, they're a part of you, and you know, you always have your memories and they're always watching over you. And like,
and what they taught you lives on with you.
Yeah, I mean, that's really high concept stuff for a Disney movie at the time. You know, we also have themes of embracing your destiny, not letting the ghosts of the past prevent you from moving forward. So like, I think, as well as the complex themes of, you know, Succession and greed and jealousy. I think there's some really kind of key concepts that, like, for me in my formative years, taught me a lot of lessons that I carry with me to this day.
There's also like a weirdly anti-fascist message under it.
There is, because is like, Be Prepared has a full-on Nazi march.
Yeah, like the hyenas are like full-on Nazis. And then like there is if you look at Scar's version of the Pride Lands when he is king and he is ruler, it's typical like dictator despot. Everything goes to shit. Nobody is looked after. Everybody fends for themselves. Everybody is starving. The collective resources are diminished.
Anyone who can leaves.
Yeah, there's like a weird and good, because it's just typically you probably interview people who are like the worst like Trumpers in the world who would also be like, oh, I love the Lion King. It's like, you do realize like the whole point of the Lion King was Scar took power by force and then everything went to shit, right? And you can see that this regime that doesn't care about like giving back to the people or ruling fair actually leads to the diminishment of everybody, and they're like, no.
I just like my tunies with the tunies.
So yeah, it's like there is like those levels in this film. Like, you can just read it as like a hero's journey, which is, you know, Simba faces adversity, comes back and triumphs, and that's there. You can read it as like all those like complex themes of greed and all the like more Shakespearean stuff in there. And then you can read that like you know, anti-dictatorship, look after people, rule fairly, all that's in there too. So yeah, it's a very deep film thematically and emotionally. Surprisingly deep.
I'm quite a liberal person, Gareth. Has The Lion King made me a liberal? Perhaps.
I don't know. I always think about that. It's like, what are the formative pieces of culture that I took and I don't realize I took? And there's probably a lot of them. But the point is that like the stuff impacts you subliminally and you don't really pick up on the things that like really stick with you and form the basis of like your values. Values is being a dirty word, but you know what I mean.
In today's world, Gar, especially in 2020, there's a movement for mindfulness, right? And one of the core messages that Rafiki tries to teach Simba is that you can't live in the past because, you know, you can't move forward, obviously. And we all spend a lot of time thinking about stuff that happened that we regret.
That's more of a Timon and Pumbaa lesson.
He makes us cringe. But yeah, but like, I suppose those two things combined, because Timon and Pumbaa are more of like, forget about it.
Move on. It means no worries.
So like the real message there is, yes, you shouldn't let it bog you down, but you still need to confront it. And, you know, we spend a lot of our time as adults, especially living in the past, regretting things, cringing about stuff that went wrong, or having conversations in our head that haven't happened yet or may never happen. So like, I think there's a message there as well, that all you can do is face what's in front of you in the moment and don't let what's happened in the past or what could happen or what you're afraid will happen stop you from, for want of a better term, embracing your destiny or moving forward, if you want to make it a bit less fantastical.
To put that succinctly, Ken, Hakuna Matata.
Fair. That's fair. I could have just said that. Gary, you touched on the Kimba the White Lion controversy. We're going to have to go there.
I haven't seen it, so I don't... I meant to watch it, but the reason we watched The Lion King right before we recorded this week is busy week, so yeah.
Certain elements of the film were thought to bear a resemblance to Osamu Tezuka's 1960 Japanese anime television series Jungle Emperor, known as Kimba the White Lion in the United States, with similarities between a number of the characters and various individual scenes. In fact, Pride Rock is actually...
There's some shots that are like... Yeah. Like, I've seen the side-to-side comparisons, you're like, somebody there did this. Come on.
And, it's okay to take inspiration, but to not acknowledge it, I think that's not fair. But the film's release, that is The Lion King, led to protests in Japan. Takayuki Matsutani...
Nailed it.
Getting there. The president of Tetsuka Productions, which created Kimba the White Lion, said in 1994, quite a few of our staff in the company saw a preview of The Lion King, discussed this subject, and came to the conclusion that you cannot avoid having similarities as long as you use animals as characters and try to draw images out of them. The studio also refuted that they'd been paid hush money,
which they totally did,
and resisted the encouragement from American lawyers to pursue litigation for fear of incurring the wrath of the Disney lawyers on their small company.
They took a paid, and fine. Disney took rip off their work, and Disney paid. It's all good in the end. They'll say, you know, they got paid in the end. That's all that matters.
The thing is, though, if they did take hush money, it most likely involved an NDA. So they
And they're like, oh, we, you know, like this. When you see some of the shots, and as I said, this film obviously has many clear inspirations. One of which is a Disney film that predates Kimba the White Lion. So like Bambi came out first.
Yeah.
So some of the beats that this film took directly from Bambi, like Bambi came out first. But there was like shots and imagery that is undeniably from that film. Yep. Like just undeniably. The directors claimed like they've never seen it. But somebody in freaking Disney, some of the animators, clearly it was inspiration from somewhere. And like this stuff does happen and it doesn't get up the chain the way it should. And it just happens. But like if they're like that, they either don't care, which I think if they were plagiarized, they'd care. Or they got some money from Disney. And if they got some money from Disney, aren't we all happy?
Yeah. You know, as I said, there was likely an NDA there, so they wouldn't be able to disclose it even if they did, and may explain why their response to the controversy matched that of Disney's as well.
Yeah, and it's all like, we don't want to pursue it, we don't want to pursue it, it's fine. Because yeah. As I said, I think if they really did feel they were plagiarized, I don't think they're like...
You wouldn't let that lie. But wouldn't. Then they're a very small animation company as well, so again, if they
financial resources.
Yeah, if they try to take on Disney, Disney's high-powered lawyers would grind them into dust. My last point here on the story, Gar, the sequence where Simba ascends to the throne after defeating Scar is, I think, the perfect ending to the movie. The story reaches its climax right as the score crescendos. I really, really love that part of the score, and combined with the striking visual of Simba climbing Pride Rock as a storm rages. So literally, like, there's no subtlety to it. Like, the washing away of the old regime, the return to the balance in the circle of life. It paints an unforgettable picture and never fails to make me emotional. As Simba is about to climb Pride Rock and take the throne, he hugs Rafiki. It creates a little lump in my throat. And it's just such a satisfying resolution for Simba's arc, you know, and considering that, you know, obviously we're still grieving for Mufasa and, you know, he tried his best to run away from it. But when he embraces his destiny, it just really puts a nice bow on the whole film.
Yeah, it's the circle of life. Again, one of the themes comes back, and then they cut to the closing shot, which is a reprise of the opening shot, but with another child. And the circle of life continues, Ken. And that's another theme of the film that is nicely wrapped up in a bow. I have to go back to the general score as well, because I think that the way the score matches the action, and especially in the songs, because I'm thinking of like Be Prepared, where it's like, and then like there's a burst of smoke in the pause in the song, which is a beat of the song, and it's really well implemented. Like the way the score works with the rest of the music and works with the animation is again another standard. It's Fantasia better than Fantasia, Ken, as I go back to burying Fantasia for no reason, but it's matching that music with what's happening on the screen in a way that's organic and satisfying a lot better than Fantasia did.
And I think if you were to distill the success of the Disney Renaissance down to its bare elements, I think that's basically it in a nutshell, that we're telling story through song, but the score itself is advancing the plot, because again, it's telling us how to feel. And I've never heard a score, and that's why I listen to it to this day, that can make me feel, well, actually Up is actually quite close now that I think about it, but like the same music, it's the exact same motif. Stop it. It's the exact same motif, that you're using the same music in different ways to convey different emotions. You know, I think that's really, really well done.
Great performances in this film. We mentioned, obviously, Jeremy Irons as Scar. We cannot go without mentioning James Earl Jones as Mufasa.
Yeah, and I'm really, really glad that they got him back for the live action film.
Is to this film as Robin Williams was to Aladdin. Like, you cannot replace him. And like, if he was not available for either, you know, if he had passed or if he just wasn't available, anybody that did that voice for another version of The Lion King would be like Simba putting his paw in the Mufasa paw at the start of the film. Yeah. You cannot fill the paw, pal. I'm sorry. But
the thing about Mufasa is that performance as well adds to the sense of loss when he dies. Because again, I talked about, you know, you get the sense of a great father. And
the majesty and the fairness and all the things you like attribute to Mufasa comes from the performance.
Yeah, the voice. And like, again, he can be tough, he can be, you know, fierce, but only because he's the king and he, you know, he has to lead by example. But we see elements of softness and kindness and love, and, you know, James Earl Jones conveys that, but his voice doesn't change too much. It's a very restrained performance, but it just, whereas if it had been done by, like, apparently Mufasa might have been envisioned in earlier films as a bit of a more of a kooky dad. Before they went to the direction of having him be the kind of wise king and the whole death sequence and the Hamlet storyline. But like, if he had been voiced by, I don't know, John Candy just pops into my mind.
Just because he was in the running for the
genie, and he was in other Disney films. If they had gone with a death storyline, I would have been like, okay, fine.
Happy he's dead. You get a... I didn't know Moira Kelly was the voice of Nell.
Yeah, I only looked it up yesterday. She was in One Tree Hill, is the one thing I know from that teen dramedy from about 10 years ago.
Yeah, she was in The West Wing.
Oh, what was she?
She was in season one of The West Wing, famously a character that just did not work out, and she disappeared. She was never written out. It's just like she was in season one, and then she just was not in season two, and the character was never mentioned again, as if she was never there. It's quite funny. Nathan Lane's Timon and Ernie Sabella's Pumbaa. Great.
Yeah.
Like, as like tropey Disney comic relief characters, which are like, we just had the very serious, like, impactful moment of Mufasa's death. We need levity. So in come Timon and Pumbaa to, like, bring some levity and jokes and happiness to the film. They do a wonderful job.
Nathan Lane, he's a very good comedian. And, like, the thing about him and Scar is the lines are obviously rehearsed and they're written, but the way they perform it, they seem spontaneous.
Yeah.
And
that's called good acting.
Yeah. And obviously, Nathan Lane comes from a musical theater background as well. So this was very much up his alley.
Yeah, and I think Matthew Broderick, perfectly fine. Like, Simba's performance is not really, or at least particularly adult Simba, there's not a ton called for from adult Simba, but when he has to do like the remember who you are stuff, he's great there.
Yeah, and the part where he confronts Scar, so there is a bit of heavy lifting to do there, but it's not as much as the younger Simba.
Simba ages through song, which is always one of my favourite things.
Yes, we've seen that in a couple of Disney films. We've seen that in Bambi, of course.
Yes,
and we will see that in Tarzan coming up, spoilers.
Like, this film is full of Disney tropes. We have the fall in love song, we have the ageing through song, we have the comic relief stuff.
It's funny, much like A Whole New World, I can objectively recognize that Can You Feel the Love Tonight is a great song, but again, it's not one of my favorites in the film.
Like, I prefer the Timon parts of that song. Like, yeah. Is that weird?
Yeah.
But because it's like, that's the more like musical theatery stuff as opposed to like a catchy pop song. Like, yeah. I can see what's happening. What? They don't have a clue. Whoopi Goldberg!
Yeah, as Shenzi, the leader of the hyenas.
Yeah, Whoopi Goldberg as a villain is a weird... Like, I never really think of it like, Whoopi Goldberg is always such a force for good in the world that when she's playing a villain.
I think Shenzi and the hyenas, Ed, and... Who's the other one?
Bonsai.
Bonsai.
Voiced by Cheech Marin.
Yeah, Marin.
Oh, is his name Marin?
Yes.
I've misread his name my entire life.
There you go. The thing about that is that they're sort of reluctant villains. I think they're...
This blew my mind.
They're go ahead, Gary.
Sorry.
The thing about that is I think they're reluctant villains and more kind of mercenaries because they're driven by their bellies, basically. They want to be able to eat, so...
They also totally murder Scar at the end. Scar's death is, like, 100 times more brutal than Mufasa's. He gets ripped to shreds by a bunch of hyena.
That's because he threw them under the bus, Scar.
Yeah. And Scar will ever scheme to the end until his schemes finally catch up with him.
Gare, obviously the legacy of this film, it is arguably the most loved and enduring Disney animated film of all time. The film inspired one of the most successful and long-running musical stage adaptations.
Which is, as I said, it's great. You should go see it. It's a tremendous musical adaptation.
While it was inspired by other works, The Lion King is the first Disney animated feature film to be based on an original story.
Which is a fun little tidbit, given we pointed out the 7 different influences it clearly draws from.
But they brought them together to create something that's derivative, but original.
It's more like a Frankenstein's monster that actually works out,
yeah.
As opposed to being an original story. Because, like, it's not. It's just not. Even putting aside the Kim of the White Lion stuff, it's so clearly based on Hamlet, and it's so clearly... It's like Bambi and Hamlet had a baby. That's what this film is.
As we know, it had many spin-off cartoons, including Timon and Pumbaa, and most recently, The Lion Guard, which apparently does fill in a lot of the lore, even though it's for... So, obviously, it's on Disney+. I've been meaning to check that out, because I love a bit of lore.
There are multiple sequel films as well. I remember there is The Lion King 1.5 or 1.5, which is basically the first film entirely from the perspective of Timon and Pumbaa. And then there's The Lion King 2. And
Simba's Pride, which is actually, for my money, the best direct-to-video sequel. And I feel like a missed opportunity. I would have liked to see that
as a theatrical release.
And given the same resources and animation and everything like that.
It's very, like when you consider how cynical companies have become about sequels now, where they will churn them out and churn them out and churn them out. It's very strange how they're like, we're going to make this thing, but we're going to release it as a straight-to-video sequel. Which is very strange. Like, that's somehow less cynical in a weird way. But I don't remember. There's a Lion King 3 as well, isn't there?
No, I don't think so.
Am I imagining that?
I think there's...
Maybe I'm thinking of Lion King 1.5, which I think was, like, tentatively Lion King 3.
I think there's 4 films, but I can't remember what the other one is.
Lion King...
Because there's the first one, there's the 3. Second one, there's the film from the point of view of Timon and Pumbaa, which is 1.5.
Yeah, 1.5 is the Lion King 3.
Yeah.
That's the third film.
Ah, yes, there we go.
So that's... where that comes from.
to wrap up, I find it interesting that this film took many of its cues from Bambi, and this formula led to a damn near perfect film nearly 40 years later. Although The Lion King was compared less favourably to adjacent films of the time by like some critics. The Beauty and the Beast. Roger Ebert didn't think it was as good as Beauty and the Beast.
It's a very different film than Beauty and the Beast. And it's less, like Beauty and the Beast is more mature, so I can kind of see why Roger Ebert would be like, this is the pinnacle of animation. Even though, if you were to put me on the spot right now and say, which of these films do I prefer? I think the answer is The Lion King.
Yeah, from an artistic point of view, I think you could possibly say Beauty and the Beast would sneak ahead of it, but from my point of view, and maybe we're biased because we have that emotional investment, I would say The Lion King.
Yeah, like this is the best Disney animated film so far. This is better than Beauty and the Beast, it's better than Sleeping Beauty, and it's better than Bambi, which are the top three at the moment. And it's obviously better than Little Mermaid and Aladdin, but like, this is the best of it. Like, it's beautifully animated, it has wonderful music, the expressions of the characters are more detailed and like emotional than they have ever been. It has a cohesive story that has remarkably deep themes on multiple levels for multiple different audiences, which I think is tremendously difficult to achieve. Top to bottom, great performances. There's, as you said, remarkably lean and efficient, and has the most like clean this three-act structure you'll ever see in your life.
Yeah, and it moves on very quickly. The pacing is very, very, very quick. Like, from the point that Mufasa dies to the climax, it's about only 40 minutes as well, but like, a lot happens, but it's all very, very tightly
done. It has I'd almost say the most clean three act structure I've ever seen in film, because like, you have the first act up to the death of Mufasa, the second act up to Remember Who You Are, and then the third act where he fights off Scar. Those are our three acts, and this, like, that is like remarkably efficient storytelling. Great performances, everything about this film works. This is the best Disney animated film.
The Lion King has remained relevant and permeated our culture more than any other Disney film before or since. It has all the elements, as you said, of fellow Disney classics, but I believe the film's core message and themes, the concepts that we all relate to throughout our lives, then and now, cause this film to endure the test of time. I think that's what The Lion King has that all these other films don't. I find it hard to put into words what The Lion King means to me, so maybe, again, as I said, we're a bit biased. And the effect that it has had on my life, it made me love animation, it made me want to do animated films. But I can say that it helped shape the person that I am today. We spoke about that earlier. The themes and the message and the lessons I still take with me. The depth of affection I have for this film, it's really hard to describe it, but it brings up such strong emotions in me that it has me coming back time after time to revisit this story. Like, as I said, Gara, I don't know, I couldn't put a number how many times I've watched The Lion King, but as I watched it earlier, all the bits that usually make me emotional still make me emotional and still well
still
up inside me.
Still works over.
Yeah.
It works. By the way, very quickly before you go to outro, Kingdom Hearts, leveling Kingdom Hearts 2, you actually get turned into lions and you run around the lions. It's very fun. And The Lion King game for the Super Nintendo, which is a hard game, and it has like Super Nintendo versions of the music, which is very, very good.
Yeah. Is it 8 bits or 16?
16-bit back then. Yeah. That would have been Super Nintendo. 16-bit versions of the Lion King score and music. It's great.
I so bought good. The reboot package, and it's such a hard game. Yeah. All these Disney games are hard. We'll talk about that as we go on, but Gary, you're talking about doing a video on your YouTube channel, if you want to plug that.
No, it won't be for Lion King. It'll probably be for Hercules, Tarzan, and A Bug's Life. Yeah. I'll probably do more of them eventually.
But your point is that, first of all, plug your YouTube channel, Gary.
YouTube.com/GareKidney.
The whole point is that these games are extraordinarily hard for children.
Yeah. And like, the reason they were made to be so hard is like, if you could beat The Lion King without it being hard, you'd beat it in like 90 minutes. Yeah. So the idea is that they make it hard and you have to restart. So it takes you 10 hours to beat this 90 minute game just because it's unfairly hard and badly designed. So yeah. And like, that comes from like, this is still the era when arcades existed. So like, the majority of games were made so that you, like, the amount of time the average player played was set to be like, whatever it is, 2 minutes. Yeah. Like the time per quarter. That was what all of this was built on. So that you wanted people to die relatively swiftly, but not so swiftly that they felt ripped off, but not that it took so long that you wouldn't get another player on fast enough. So that's the entire economics of video games until you bring it into the home console, where you have to wean yourself off of that kind of game design. It's like, if you watch the development of games in the late 80s and early 90s, it's kind of fascinating to watch that dynamic play itself out.
You just want to hit that sweet spot where they feel like they've gotten far enough that they want to put that extra quarter in to keep going,
but don't sit there for an hour hogging the machine on one quarter.
All right, Simbas and Nalas. Sadly, we've nearly come to the end of the show for another week. Magic by Design's resident musical expert Nicole is coming up in but a moment with another unmissable musical performance. It's always a highlight of the show each week, so stay with us for that after the credits. You can find new episodes of Magic by Design every Monday, where all magical podcasts are downloaded. Check out our website at magicbydesign.buzzsprout.com to find a full list of podcast providers. There, you will also find all our previous episodes if you're catching up or feel like revisiting an old favourite. There's some really good ones in the pipeline now, so there's going to be...
All of them are good. Our episodes are amazing. I recommend you go back and listen to the Black Cauldron episode so that you can remember the film exists. I recommend you go back and listen to the Aristocats episode, where you can hear us bury a film for an hour. These are the very important hits you can go back and listen to.
Magic by Design is on all your favourite social media platforms. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/magicbydesignpod, on Twitter at magicdesignpod, and on the Insta at magicbydesignpod. If you enjoy listening to our Disney discussions and want to support the show, please do consider giving us a 5-star review on your podcast platform of choice. Share the podcast on your socials or recommend the show to a fellow Disney fan. If you don't give us a 5-star review, well, let's just say, be prepared.
We're going to kill him.
Oh no.
Be prepared for the death of the podcast listener. Stick with me and you'll never get a 1-star review again. We'll be back next week at the same time, same place, with Disney's 33rd animated feature, Pocahontas. But until then, stay safe and remember, the past can hurt, but the way I see it, you can either run from it or learn from it. Now then, Nicole was terribly indecisive again this week, so she's bringing you another magnificent musical medley of her favourite songs from The Lion King.
Even more than last week. She's doing more songs.
You're welcome. And she's also prepared some of her usual fun facts about the music of the film. What more could you want? Thanks for listening, and take it away, Nicole.
Hello there, my Disney fans. It's me, your musical correspondent Nicole, coming to you live from my bedroom. This week we're looking at the King of Kings, the Lion King. Lyricist Tim Rice returned for this animation on the condition he'd be allowed a writing partner. Alan Menken was not available, so Tim suggested Elton John, and management agreed. Rice and John wrote 5 songs for the film, including Circle of Life, I Just Can't Wait to Be King, Be Prepared, Hakuna Matata, and Can You Feel the Love Tonight? Hans Zimmer composed the score for the movie. Now, some of you might recognise that name. Well, because he composed music for over 150 films. In my opinion, he's most known for his noughties movies. So, Gladiator, Hannibal, The Last Samurai, Da Vinci Code, Pirates of the Caribbean, the list goes on. He continues to be the main man for film scores these days too. The score was also supplemented with traditional African music and choir elements by Lebo M, a South African composer. His voice is the one you hear in the opening credits singing the traditional chant. The soundtrack is the best-selling soundtrack album to an animated film in the United States with over 7 million copies sold. Award-wise, it won Academy Awards and Golden Globes for Best Original Song for Can You Feel the Love Tonight and won Best Original Score, as well as numerous Grammy Awards. This week, following on from last week's medley, I've decided to keep it up. So here are my favourite songs from The Lion King. I hope you enjoy it. It's the circle of life, and it moves us all through this fair and cold, through faith and
inspiring thing. Oh, I just can't wait to be king.
dancing to the
Now when I said that,
no one seemed to be there.
What?
No one